about a question that I asked to me a few years ago, whether it would be possible to generalize the discrete logarithm problem to some slightly more general class of problems. And, well, when I asked me this question, it was in 97, I guess, well, I could find one non-trivial generalization of this discrete log problem. And since then, I have been regularly discussing this question with colleagues, and especially with David Coel and Antoine Joux. But I have to confess that we did not make much progress in the last 9 years. So I believe the state of this question has not changed much since 1997. So the question is the following: can we sort of encapsulate discrete logarithm problems into some more general class of problems? So of course I want to give a definition and a name to this more general type of problems, so I call them hard homogeneous spaces. So in the first part of my talk, I will explain what I mean by this. And then in the second part of my talk, I will present this example of this situation, which is not a DL problem, but which is, well, which belongs to this more general class of problem. And then I will finish with remarks and questions. So the starting point is, well, to consider a discrete logarithm problem. So you have a group G, and you have G and H elements in G. And the question is, well, can you give an exponent n such that g to the n is h? So this is a DL problem. And maybe the first observation is that this discrete logarithm problem does not really use the group structure of g. You don't need g to be a group in order to define this problem. Well, it may seem like a provocation to say that, because after all, g to the n is just g times g times g n times, so it seems that in order to define g to the n, you are just using the group law. But I prefer to forget this aspect of things and to consider that g to the n is just g acted on by some exponent n. So I will regard n as some element in some group. Acting on the set G. So I just forget that G is a group, but N will be an element in some group. So which group? Well, that's clear. If you assume that the group generated by G is a cyclic group of order, say, gamma, then the exponents actually belong to the group Z over gamma Z star. They're just invertible modulo gamma. And I will denote this group by A. And certainly this group A acts on G. Well, indeed, A is the automorphism group of G. But again, I don't want to look at G as a group. I prefer to restrict to some subset inside G the subset consisting of generators of G. So certainly A acts on G, and certainly it acts on the generators of G. So A. So what remains of all that is that I have a group acting on some set H. And what's happening here is that the cardinal of the group A is equal to the cardinal of the set H, and the action is transitive, meaning that if you take any two elements, H1 and H2, two generators of the group G, they are certainly mapped, well, they can correspond through the action of A. There is necessarily some exponent N which maps H1 to H2, given H1 and H2. There exist some, say, N, an exponent in A, such that H1 to the N is H2. So this is what transitive means. And it is free. Free means that, well, this N is unique. So given two elements in A, there is a unique element in H and a unique group element in H. Sorry, it's the contrary. Given two elements in H, there is a unique A in capital A that maps the first H1 to the second H2. Okay, so this is what people usually call a homogeneous space under some group. It's just a set which is acted on freely and transitively by the group. Okay. So, this is not a very original situation. I mean, we do know a lot of such homogeneous spaces. For example, if you take some vector space, let K be a field, for example, the real, and let H be the dimension 2 vector space over R. A. So this is a group with the plus low. And let H be the affine plane of dimension 2. Okay. Well, if I have a point P in H and a vector V in A, certainly I can add the vector to the point, and this produces a new point Q, well, which is defined by the property that PQ vector equals V. So I may write Q is just P acted on by V. This is an example of homogeneous space because clearly it's transitive. Between any two points there is a vector, and it is free because between P and Q there is a unique vector sending P to Q, that is the vector PQ. So we have at least two examples of homogeneous spaces. Here this is just a vector space case, well, affine and vector space, and here this is a discrete log case. And well, they are very similar except from the point of view of complexity theory, of course. If I am given two points in the plane, P and Q, that's very easy to compute the vector V which maps P to Q because, well, the x coordinate of V is just the difference between the x coordinates of Q and P, and same for the y coordinate. So given 2 points, it's very easy to find out a vector which maps the first point to the second point. Well, of course, in the case of discrete log, well, as you know, in general, given 2 generators of a cyclic group, it's difficult to find the exponent that maps the first generator to the second generator. So this problem I call the vectorization problem. You are given a homogeneous space, H, and you are given 2 points, P and Q, in this homogeneous space, and the question is find the unique vector inside A that maps P to Q. And, well, if this problem is difficult, then I will say that the homogeneous space is difficult. So maybe now I can give a more precise definition of what could be a homogeneous vector space, hard homogeneous vector space. So to start with, it's a homogeneous space, so I need a group A and a homogeneous space H. I need everything to be easy but the vectorization problem, so to say. So I need A to be computational, so to say, so I can perform operations in A efficiently. And also H is computational. Well, there is no operation to perform in H, but at least I can check if 2 elements are equal, for example. And also the action of A on H is computational and can be computed efficiently. This means that given a group element and given a point in the set H, I can compute the action of the group element on the point. And the last condition, which is the most important, is that the vectorization problem is hard. So given 2 points, P and Q, it's difficult to find the vector V that maps P to Q. So if I do that, well, if I want to, well, the goal would be to see whether cryptography based on discrete log can be extended to cryptography based on homogeneous spaces. I mean, if I want to do that, I have to introduce a very natural problem, which is a bit easier than vectorization. It is the following one, given 3 points P, Q, and R. Can you guess out the point S that completes the parallelogram P, R, S, Q? So this is just asking that PS, the vector PS, is equal to PR Q plus PR. So this trivially is just the computational Diffie-Hellman problem, but just rephrased in the context of homogeneous spaces. And as you can see, you don't need P, Q, R, and S to be group elements to formulate this problem. It's just a question of points. So in fact, this is the parallelogram problem, and in my definition, rather than asking that this problem is hard, I would prefer to ask that the parallelogram problem. Is hard. And of course, if the parallelogram problem is hard, certainly the vectorization problem is hard also. So for the moment, I mean, we did not have to pay very much. We just gave definitions, so it doesn't hurt. And the question then was, could I find an example of hard homogeneous space which would not be trivially a discrete logarithm problem? So an example in which H would really not be a group, or would really not be embedded trivially into some group. And indeed, there is a natural example of such a situation, which is provided by class field theory. And which concerns, well, essentially using complex multiplication abelian varieties, but I will just, well, I mean, the most natural and probably the only reasonable one concerns elliptic curve. So you take Q be a prime power, and FQ the field with Q element, and E an elliptic curve over FQ, which you assume to be ordinary. So now I introduce a few classical notations. I call T the trace of the Frobenius of the elliptic curve. So I have the number of points of FQ points is Q plus 1 minus T. I have, well, I call E, end of E, the endomorphism ring of E, I denote it by O. This is, in that case, this is an imaginary quadratic ring, and it contains a subring generated by the Frobenius, which is a finite index. The discriminant of this smaller ring is T squared minus 4Q, and this is equal to the discriminant of O times some square integer, theta squared. Well, I mean, if you pick random curves, it's not very difficult to manage to find curves for which you actually have the equality between these two rings, and it simplifies a little bit computations. So I will call A, so A will be the group in my homogeneous space. A will be the class group of O, which is a class group of the endomorphism ring of the elliptic curve, where it has size about square root of Q. I recall, and for H, so I need to introduce a space which is acted on, a space or a set, which is acted on by A. So I take for H the set of elliptic curves over FQ such that the endomorphism ring, so let's call these elliptic curves F, why not? Such that the endomorphism ring of F is the same as the endomorphism ring of E, so it's O, and the cardinality of the group of points of F is the same as the number of points on E. And of course I look at that up to isomorphism. If I do that, the cardinality of H is equal to the cardinality of A, so it sounds good. And indeed I do have an action. A acts on H, And this action is nice in the sense that it is indeed transitive and free. So this is for the mathematical part, but for the moment, I mean, we just introduced definition and mathematical properties. Now we have to study this problem from the point of view of complexity. Does this produce an example of hard homogeneous space? I need two conditions essentially. I need this action to be somewhat easy to compute, and I need the vectorization problem or the parallelogram problem, even better, to be difficult to solve. At least you can observe that we really have a non-trivial example in the sense that H is definitely not a group. If I give you two elliptic curves, I mean, you cannot cook up a third elliptic curve out of these two. I mean, I have two elliptic curves. There is no natural way to construct a third elliptic curve out of these two elliptic curves. So it's definitely not a group. Okay, so certainly I will not prove that it is difficult to, first of all, let's prove that the action of A on H in that case can be, is, so to say, easy. Well, it's realistic, so to say. So first of all, I have to define this action. So if you don't like class field theory, maybe you can just skip the next 3 minutes. So I have to take some element in A, so let gamma be some class, ideal class inside the class group of the ring O, and let I be an element in this class, so I is an ideal inside the endomorphic ring of the elliptic curve, say E. And out of this, so I have this ideal and I have this elliptic curve E, I want to construct a new elliptic curve that would be the result of the action of gamma on E. So the way classically one can do that is to construct some subgroup, finite subgroup K of the elliptic curve, which is defined to be the intersection of all kernels of elements in I. So before doing that, I have maybe to assume a few extra conditions. For example, I will introduce the norm of I to be the quotient of the cardinality of the quotient O by I, and I call it N. And I assume N is prime to the characteristic P and also to the discriminant P2 minus 4Q. And to make it more natural, more simple, I also assume that the group O quotiented by I is a cyclic group. This is just a non-triviality condition. I mean, if it were not cyclic, it just means that I can take a smaller I. Okay, and now I consider this K, which is just the intersection of all kernels of all elements in I. Of course, I have infinitely many elements in I, but it suffices to take the intersection of two generators of I. For example, I can generate I by a couple of elements, like N, which is the norm, plus some other element, which is well chosen, which I call capital I. So for any ideal, I have such a generating set. So this is nothing but En, the N torsion on the elliptic curve E, intersected with the kernel of this capital I. So this is reasonably easy to compute, and once I have that, I have a subgroup of index of order N inside the elliptic curve E, and I consider the quotient of E by K, I call K is quotient, so this defines an isogeny. And this F will be, by definition, the result of the action of the class gamma on the elliptic of E. And of course, I mean, it's not trivial to say that, because you have to prove it's independent on the gamma, on the I you have chosen inside gamma, etc. But this is, well, classically something people do in class field theory. And this defines an action, and as you can see, this action can be computed in time, which is the complexity of all that, polynomial in the size of the field log Q, well, logarithm the size of the field, and what, and the norm of the ideal I, little n. So this raises a few observations. So first of all, when I studied these things, it was in 97, people started actually computing such isogenies, but there were very few people in the world being really able to do that. I believe Oliver Atkin was computing things like that. François Morin in Paris was also computing things like that. Probably people in Waterloo also were computing things like that. And Buchmann also, and Müller in Saarbrücken were computing things like that. But I mean, it was theoretically polynomial time. In practice, it was really difficult. So it was a bit science fiction to speak of that 9 years ago. In the meantime, there have been a lot of progress in how to compute actual isogenies between elliptic curves. And now it goes really fast. Well, I believe faster. First observation, and the second observation is that we have to pay attention to something. I mean, the complexity is polynomial in n, n being the degree of the ideal we have inside the class gamma. But in general, most classes in the class group will not contain ideal with small norm. I mean, only few classes have an ideal with small norm in it. But that's no problem, because under some heuristic assumptions, you can assume that these small classes, so to say, do generate the whole group. So you can realize every element in the group as a combination of these small classes, and these small classes, you can compute the action. So this is important because since we are not in a group, H is not a group, we cannot use fast exponentiation. And fast exponentiation is what makes discrete log interesting, because it makes the exponentiation easy. I mean, discrete log would not be interesting if the exponentiation were not easy. So here we do not have fast exponentiation because we cannot multiply two elliptic curves, but instead of that, we have a generating set for our group, which has the property that every element in this generating set can be applied efficiently to element in H. Okay. So now, if you like dynamical systems, you may regard this H, well, this H is a set of points. We have a large set of points. Which you may regard as states of some system. And you have the group A acting on this set of states. So you may look at these arrows as just commands, so to say. And you have the property that for any two states in the system, there is one and just one command that switch from one state to the other state. But and you have, among all these possible commands, you have a small subset of commands that generate the whole group of commands. And these few commands, you can apply them efficiently. You can really manage them. This is the situation. So of course, we also have to make some complexity assumption in that case, because if you are doing discrete log, you assume that discrete log is difficult. I mean, there is no group for which it is proven that discrete log is difficult. And here, that's the same situation. I mean, you have to assume that this problem, given two elliptic curves, construct an isogeny between them is a difficult problem. I don't really need to construct the isogeny explicitly, after all. I would just be happy if I could give the class inside the class group on some abstract basis. So I don't really need to actually write down equations for this isogeny. Just the class would be enough. This, I believe, is a difficult problem, but of course I cannot prove it. And similarly, if I am given three elliptic curves, I want to complete the parallelogram, so to say, by constructing a fourth elliptic curve in such a way that, well, this relation which I have erased holds. And this also, I believe, is a difficult question. So now I will finish by making a few comments and raising maybe a few questions. So this was in 97, and in the meantime I have discussed with colleagues, and in particular with David Cowell, and we try to find out other examples. Well, I don't speak about abelian varieties because this is the immediate generalization of that, and you cannot consider that as a different example. So we have tried to construct, we had candidates for other examples, but they all showed to be insecure, so I mean we could not come out with anything else than that, I have to say. Well, recently Antoine Joux told me that it could be a good idea to circulate my preprint because maybe it would be to interest to some people, and actually it's true that some people have been working on related topics. In particular, you may have noticed that the talk by Zhao was concerned with similar things, but there are many other ideas in their work. In particular, they really consider isogenies as maps. Namely, they consider points on the elliptic curves, and they use these isogenies to map points from one elliptic curve to the other elliptic curve. Here, I really don't consider isogenies as maps between elliptic curves. I just consider isogenies as actions, so to say, from one elliptic curve to one other elliptic curve on some abstract base. And I don't care about points on these elliptic curves. For me, these elliptic curves are just points. And I just worry about the J invariants, so to say. In 99, there were a paper by Galbraith in which he addresses this problem: given two isogenies, given two elliptic curves, how do you construct an isogeny between the two? And I mean, this is just Shank's algorithm. You have, this is general. If you are given two elements in a homogeneous space, and you have this set of commands which you may apply, so you apply at random commands to the first point, you apply at random commands to the second point. And because of the birthday paradox, I mean, if you have square root of the size of H here and square root of the size of H here, with high probability, these two trees are going to meet together, and it gives you a path from the one to the other one. So it means that, in some sense, Shank's algorithm is not something which is connected with groups. I mean, it makes sense also in this poorer context. So this is what I believe was in Galbraith's paper. I have a question which is very naive, but I don't know anything about quantum computers, so I ask, is this kind of problem more difficult from the point of view of quantum computers than discrete logarithm? I mean, can these problems dealt with efficiently by a quantum computer, I mean, given two elliptic curves, find an isogeny between the two, I don't know. Is it essential for attacking discrete log problem with a quantum computer that you really have a group or not? This is a question I don't know. Another question which was asked to me independently by Antoine Joux and Jean-Jacques Quisquater is, well, in the meantime people have invented pairing-based cryptography, so is there an analog to pairing-based cryptography in this slightly more general context? Well, at least theoretically there is some. I mean, it doesn't cost anything to give a definition, you just take three homogeneous spaces under the action of the same group, and you assume that you have a map from the Cartesian product of the two ones to the third one, which is compatible with group actions, and you ask, well, then everything works as before. The interesting point, of course, is that is there any example of a situation which is not coming from a group situation? And I have to say that I have thought a little bit of this, and I could not find a single example. I mean, here I have a single example, here I have none. I mean, I cannot give a single example of this more general situation, which really is not coming from groups. For example, mathematically, I may say, okay, I take here the set of all elliptic curves isogenous to a given elliptic curve. I take here the set of all elliptic curves, the same set, isogenous to a given elliptic curve. And if I have two elliptic curves, E1 and E2, I may associate to them the product, which is an abelian surface. So here I have a set of abelian surfaces, which are product of two isogenous elliptic curves. So this is indeed a map which satisfies all the expected mathematical properties. The only problem here is that this set is not computational, in the sense that if I am given four elliptic curves, E1, E2, E3, and E4, my impression is that it is very difficult to decide if these two products are isogenous, are isomorphic or not. I mean, it's just equivalent to the decision Diffie-Hellman problem in the context we have here. So I believe it's difficult. So we do not produce anything new with this example, unfortunately, I guess, unless someone finds out an interesting way of deciding such a thing. Given four elliptic curves, can you decide whether or not these two products are isomorphic as abelian varieties? I mean as abelian varieties, not polarized abelian varieties. That's the important point. So to finish with, I mean, I would like to say that if we summarize, we have a lot of more or less similar problems. We have discrete log in finite fields, discrete log in elliptic curves. We have this strange isogeny problem. And you also have the problem which is addressed in the paper by Yao, which is sort of interplay between the isogeny problem and the discrete log problem. And actually, there is a theory which encapsulates all these problems, which is a class field theory, and which could be expressed in the following way. In all situations, you have something similar, so to say. In every such situation, what you have is an extension of number fields. For example, in the usual discrete log problem, what you have is an extension of Q by some cyclotomic field. And so in general, this will be K and this will be L. You have a Galois group here acting. This Galois group will be the A we are interested in. And you take a prime P that splits, prime P in K that splits completely in L, and you reduce mod P. So if you do that, what you get is that instead of K, you are going to have some, let's say, FP or FQ, FP say. And instead of L, well, because it splits, you will not have a field extension, you will have an algebra, an FP to the A. So here, the automorphism group is A, and here, the automorphism group is the full symmetric group, but sort of hidden inside this full symmetric group, there is the initial Galois group, which is sort of hidden there. And in some cases, in all cases coming from class field theory, this Galois action can be computed by, so to say, geometric means. like exponentiation or isogenies or things like that. And these geometric means, they do make sense even if you reduce mod p because they are just coming from geometry. So in that case, this A still exists as an automorphism of this algebra, and this is what produces the homogeneous space we are interested in, whether it is discrete log in finite fields or discrete log on elliptic curves or the isogeny problems or the mixed of the two. I mean, each of these four problems correspond to well-chosen extensions, abelian extensions coming from class field theory. Okay, so it's all I have to say. Thank you.